Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Cliff Douglas. He's the executive director of the University of Michigan's Tobacco Research Network and an advisor on tobacco policy for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. He's also represented plaintiffs in litigation against the tobacco industry. It's a particularly good time for me to be talking with him because it's the 50th anniversary of the original Surgeon General's report on the dangers of smoking. Cliff, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Grant.
Well, let me start with a few broad questions, and we'll get into some more details later. But where are we as a nation right now compared with our own past in terms of smoking behavior?
As the new Surgeon General's report highlights, we have come an extraordinary distance from what this nation looked like with regard to tobacco use and the death and disability that resulted from it back at the time of the first report in 1964. In public health, we recognize the tobacco control campaign over these past five decades as probably the single most successful public health campaign in the history of the United States, if not the world. There is a paradox there because while we've succeeded, studies now show, in saving about 8 million lives since that first Surgeon General's report, we have at the same time also lost 16 or 17 million of our family members and friends in this country due to tobacco use. So it's a big pro and a large con at the same time.
So smoking-related deaths are going down. Is that right?
Well, it's interesting. In a sense, yes. But the new report documents that, in fact, because we have identified additional illnesses, fatal illnesses caused by cigarette smoking, the new data show that close to 500,000 Americans are still dying annually from cigarette smoking, whereas the previous number was about 440,000. So it's a difficult one.
How do we compare with other countries around the world in terms of smoking behavior? I mean, I've traveled a bit, and there are some countries in Europe. It just seems like everybody's smoking, you know.
Yeah, there's a pretty significant difference between the developed and the developing worlds, West and East. In this country, for example, our smoking rate is now in the vicinity of 18 or 19%. So, I mean, we're still talking about one out of five adults and young adults and even adolescents as well. But on the other hand, if you look at the other extreme in China, for example, where there are more smokers than we have people in the U.S., something in the neighborhood of 70% of adult males smoke. So you've got this extraordinary range. While we're improving things significantly here, there are large swaths of the world that are facing decades to come of serious problems due to their smoking rates being so high.
And are there big variations within our own country when it comes to smoking in terms of areas of the country or demographic groups?
Absolutely. Smoking is a really particularly good example of the problem that we have with disparities in public health. Roughly half of all of the cigarettes smoked in the United States are used by people who are suffering from diagnosed or diagnosable mental illness or substance abuse problems, which is rather extraordinary. And that's important because this is something that has not been adequately recognized in previous years, but that we are looking at now. And there is also a very significant correlation between one's socioeconomic status and educational level and whether or not they smoke. So we actually do have a pretty big range depending on which part of the population you're looking at and even where they do live, for example, urban versus rural.
And what are there some within the country in terms of region? I mean, I would think just going into it that, you know, tobacco-producing states are going to have higher rates or the South would have a higher rate. Maybe that's just a knee-jerk, you know, assumption.
Well, you're actually correct there. We see more serious problems with smoking rates and the illnesses that result from cigarette smoking in the southeastern states. And one big reason for that, by the way, is not only that they are quote-unquote tobacco country and there are cultural differences, but the level of tobacco prevention policies that have been adopted in those states is really less effective than what we've seen around much of the country, for example, in New York State and in New York City. So if you look in a state like Kentucky, for example, you're going to see that that tax rates are going to tend to be lower, and that's significant because tobacco taxes are one of the most influential, you know, things that you can do in order to reduce tobacco use, especially among kids. And then other policies as well, smoke-free policies and the like. So that's what's affecting these major differences in different geographical regions.
And the politics is going to have an effect on that, obviously, I would think, in terms of whether a state is going to have a more or less friendly climate toward those kinds of regulations and policies, depending on what their economy is based on.
You know, it's really interesting in terms of the dynamics. It's true that historically, tobacco-growing states and tobacco-manufacturing states have been much more reticent, shall we say, to take on the tobacco epidemic than other parts of the country. But we are seeing changes in that regard. And to just cite an example, if you look at South Carolina, the University of South Carolina just this month in January adopted a fully comprehensive tobacco-free policy for its campus. And that's the flagship university in South Carolina, Deep South tobacco, you know, history and everything. And we are seeing those types of changes take place. So it really does bode well, I think, for what we're going to be doing in the future all around the country.
And you mentioned other demographic differences. I would think, again, just going in on assumption that the smoking rate is going to be higher among those that are less well off and lower among the rich and the better off. Is that true?
Education, if there's any top level sort of correlation between whether one smokes or not, you start with education. And while there's a general understanding that among virtually everyone that smoking is not good for you, when you get into the details, people really don't tend to understand the nature, the severity of the disease. Even if you talk to an educated population, most people don't know that roughly one half, literally about 50% of all long-term cigarette smokers die directly as a result of their cigarette smoking. But there are now upwards of a dozen or more cancers that are identified as being caused by cigarette smoking, diabetes, whole range of illnesses, including some new ones that were identified in this new Surgeon General's report. But when you look at the understanding of those with less education, I mean, they really get it a lot less. And you see that reflected in their health behaviors, and cigarette smoking is sort of exhibit A in that area.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with tobacco control policy expert and advocate Cliff Douglas. I wanted to pick up on this theme that we've been talking about the demographic differences. I also wonder whether there's not sort of a relationship between culture and economics in a way, and that you were emphasizing the educational piece of it, that people with more education are going to really better and more deeply understand just how harmful this is to them in different ways. But I also wonder whether there's not just a sense of in some among some demographic groups that smoking just isn't done. You know, there's an informal taboo against it, whereas in other subgroups, you know, it's okay. Can you talk about that?
That's an interesting question. You know, we talk about this concept of social norm change and social norming. Clearly, among different demographic groups in our country, there are variations in that area. Overall, social norms have changed really dramatically around cigarette smoking. There's a chicken and egg that goes in different directions here. For example, the fact that people became concerned about secondhand smoke exposure starting back in the 70s and 80s has led to dramatic change in terms of eliminating exposure to secondhand smoke in public places and workplaces, you know, restaurants and bars, and so on. And that has helped to drive social norm change. But at the same time, it's because of people's concerns about this, we've seen those very different types of policies come into place in more recent years. But of course, in certain areas, cultures are different. The areas, for example, of the country out west, the western United States, where there's a, let's say, more of a, you know, live and let live, a sort of attitude, kind of out on the range kind of thing, not to stereotype, but there really are some different feelings around that. And so you may see it may be less likely that these types of policies are going to be promoted in those places, and people may just kind of say, I'm just going to do this. And besides, many people who smoke tend to sort of psychologically feel that it's not going to hurt them. You know, it's human nature to think, well, there may be problems out there, but it's not going to affect me. And that's one of the things we deal with, especially when you start to deal with behavior that's so addictive.
You were mentioning before smoking rates in China and other countries that are developing or less developed. How do, from a comparative perspective, are smoking regulations and smoking policies about and policies about tobacco, how do they compare with the rest of the world? Are we the leader there in terms of these kinds of efforts, or are we sort of along with the rest of the Western countries? Where are we?
The picture there is actually a little bit complicated. For many years, certainly in the years following that first seminal Surgeon General's report back in the early 60s, the U.S. really was seen and was the world leader in combating this epidemic. But in more recent years, we've seen nations all around the world taking really very proactive and progressive steps at a policy level to combat this epidemic. So now we have, for example, several dozen countries with large graphic warning labels on cigarette packs, something that we don't have in the U.S. Here it's because the U.S. Supreme Court recently rejected the Food and Drug Administration's effort to impose those because we have a constitution with the First Amendment and they took a different – but as a result, we are not the leader in some ways. But at the same time, the U.S. is doing a good job. And I do want to highlight there because it's really important here that it depends on our presidential administration as well. And under this administration, the Obama administration has appointed several key officials in leadership positions at the Department of Health and Human Services, at the Centers for Disease Control, and elsewhere, who know a lot about this area and have taken very assertive positions in combating the tobacco epidemic, as well as dealing with a host of other public health challenges. So Tom Frieden at the CDC and Kathleen Sebelius and Bill Kaur and Howard Koh at the Department of Health and Human Services have helped lead efforts to strengthen our tobacco control policies in this country.
I was curious about that very specific thing, and I was going to ask you about this later, but I'll ask you about it now. So President Obama is a recovering smoker.
Right.
And this was very public, his struggle with this.
Yes.
And he's talked about it. And I was thinking about this. I think he's the first sort of – he was, when he was elected, the first sort of smoker president since Nixon. I wonder if that awareness of the, you know, hey, this is tough to break. This is, you know, this is a hard thing to get off of, affects the administration's policies from him on down.
Well, back in 2009, I was at the White House on the day just a few months into President Obama's new administration when he signed into law this new authority for the Food and Drug Administration to regulate tobacco products. For the first time in our history, until then, the FDA regulated toothpaste and orange juice, but it couldn't touch tobacco, the leading preventable cause of death. And at that signing ceremony in the Rose Garden, the president made reference to his own history of struggling with this this addictive behavior. And, of course, the fact that he had started, like most of us who have smoked or do smoke, in his teenage years. And so he obviously has some very personal feelings about this and recognizes that this is not an easy fix, that people struggle with this addiction. And, you know, I can't say how much it's informed his approach to policy in this area, but I think it's very helpful when people in these decision-making positions do understand it at the same time that, you know, that they become educated in the science. It helps when they can feel it viscerally.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and I'm talking with tobacco control expert and advocate Cliff Douglas. I wanted to ask you a question about policy here in terms of the match or the mismatch between policies that you think would be the most desirable for us to have and then the ones that are most politically viable. Are there some kinds of policies that are particularly desired but are just really difficult to get passed?
We know clearly which policies are effective in reducing tobacco use, in reducing prevalence, in other words, the number of people who smoke, and also reducing consumption, how much they smoke. And those policies include, for example, raising the price of cigarettes and other tobacco products. And, of course, the way we can do that through government policy is by raising tobacco taxes. Another is implementing smoke-free policies in the whole range of places that where that can be done. And then there are others like implementing good, strong mass media campaigns, such as the Tips from Former Smokers campaign that the Centers for Disease Control has run over the past year and a half, which has been enormously effective in driving people to call Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW, and take other measures to quit smoking.
We have some of these in New York, too, that are they're pretty dramatic. You know.
That's right. And New York actually has served as a really nice example at times for the rest of the United States in leading the way on this. In New York City, of course, under a former Mayor Bloomberg, did a lot of cutting-edge stuff, and the numbers show that it works. So we know that those things work. Politically, we've had increasing success in moving those policies in the U.S. and in many parts of the country at the state and local level. You know, it's typical to find some challenge in raising taxes of any kind, of course. Mm-hmm. And it's not easy to do it with cigarette taxes. President Obama, for example, in a recent budget, promoted a 94-cent increase in the federal cigarette excise tax rate. And we haven't seen Congress go along with that yet. At the same time, we know from surveys that the public supports raising tobacco taxes. It seems to be the one tax that the majority of Americans favor because they know that it helps improve health, and particularly because it dramatically reduces consumption by kids. And we all want to protect the health and well-being and future of our children.
Has there ever really been a serious consideration in our modern time of just an outright ban on tobacco, similar to what we tried with alcohol during the Prohibition?
Well, you know, that's an issue that comes up. And in fact, recently when I was at the White House for the formal release of the new Surgeon General's report, that question was asked. Mm. And our acting Surgeon General responded by saying, you know, that is an issue whose time may have come to at least have on the table, at least to talk about it. But as he said, and he was correct, it is a very political issue. This is not something that's going to be determined by our nation's health authorities. That's the kind of issue that ultimately will be determined by the Congress, the President of the United States, and it's going to depend in large part on the cultural evolution that we have undergone here in this country in terms of our population's perspectives on tobacco and how seriously we feel about eventually ending this epidemic once and for all.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and I'm talking with tobacco control expert and advocate Cliff Douglas. You were talking before about how everyone agrees that, you know, we want to try to keep young people from smoking as much as we can. More generally, are there certain kinds of frames that work better for making arguments for more regulation than others? For example, you know, you could talk about this as a problem of one of lessening the overall public harm, you know, harm reduction. And then you could make a more individual argument about, you know, you're hurting others with your secondhand smoke. In your experience, do some work better than others?
Well, it's hard to quantify, you know, which is at the top of the list and what comes next. But we do know that several messages, and they're very real and accurate messages, are effective. One clearly is focusing on kids' welfare. The leading national tobacco prevention advocacy organization is called the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids for a reason, although they do focus on fighting the epidemic among everyone, including adults. You know, that is their frame for this, and it makes sense. At the same time, we are concerned about not harming others, and the secondhand smoke issue became really truly a significant part of our message and policy focus, because it's one thing, arguably, to engage in behavior that hurts yourself. But most of us would agree that it's really inappropriate for us to engage in behaviors that threaten others. You know, drinking and driving is a prime example of that. Smoking in the presence of others is another really good example of that.
And I've read that when it comes to the health harm that comes from smoking, it's not really mainly the thing that people are actually addicted to, the nicotine. It's the so-called delivery device for the nicotine, the traditional cigarette that someone smokes. So do you think that these electronic cigarettes are good things as a good way to get people, to paraphrase that old smoking ad, you know, not to fight but to switch?
That's right. Electronic cigarettes are rapidly growing in this country, and they have become a major topic in this whole area of tobacco prevention and how best on a holistic level to deal with this epidemic. You know, it's not like the old days, whenever those were, when you just had a cigarette that was tobacco rolled up in paper. Now we have a plethora of nicotine delivery devices. And by the way, going to your initial point there, cigarettes, conventional cigarettes, have been likened to a dirty needle. Their key purpose, as tobacco industry previously secret internal documents frequently refer to, is the delivery of nicotine. It's to cause and then sustain drug addiction. The chief problem with it, of course, is that you're addicting people to a product that, when burned, produces upwards of 7,000 chemicals, more than 70 of them being identified as known human carcinogens, and you'll find this in the new Surgeon General's report as well. Now, on the issue of e-cigarettes, the challenge right now is that you've got upwards of 1 million users in the United States, or at least those who have seriously tried them. People use them for a couple of reasons. One is this notion of harm reduction. I'm addicted to nicotine. I really want to get off of cigarettes. So if I can use this other product that gives me the drug fix without all of the chemicals connected. So that's, you know, to reduce their harm.
Sort of like a patch or something.
It could be like a patch.
Yeah.
Another reason, of course, is some people use e-cigarettes in an attempt to try to quit smoking. So it's a cessation device. Now, here's the problem. They're wholly unregulated right now. And the regulatory body that has the authority to do something about e-cigarettes is the Food and Drug Administration. And they have been looking at e-cigarettes for some time now. And we have been expecting them to come forward with a proposed rule involving the regulation of these products, because there's no standardization. There are hundreds of these products circulating in the U.S., many of them coming from overseas, from China. But now we also have the major cigarette manufacturers, Philip Morris, Lorillard, R.J. Reynolds, Brown & Williamson, all coming in with their own electronic cigarette brands. It's hard to know what's in them. There's no proof as of yet that they help you quit smoking. There's no proof as of yet that they even will reduce your disease risk. And here's the complication. I just want to add this, and it's a little bit technical. The tobacco industry is promoting, and there is a phenomenon which proves that this is working, the dual usage of conventional cigarettes and e-cigarettes. In other words, people don't quit their Marlboro. What they do is they may cut down on their Marlboro, but you use e-cigarettes to bridge those times when they can't smoke their Marlboro. And the problem with that is that even if you're only smoking 1 to 5 regular cigarettes a day, you are multiplying your lung cancer risk by 300 to 400%. Higher for women, a little bit lower for men. The only way to eliminate the serious risks from conventional cigarette smoking is to get off them entirely.
Now, I've heard a particular observation or argument about smoking that comes from an economic perspective, and, well, it seems a bit perverse, but I wanted to get your reaction to it. It goes like this. Smoking actually can save society money because it kills people. It kills them faster and at younger ages than they would otherwise die, and therefore they don't use as much medical care in their retirement years when it's real expensive. And these folks die before they can also draw much of their Social Security. So we get the benefits of their working years and their tax payments into all these programs at a bargain of lower payouts overall. What do you make of that?
It's an argument that was made in a once secret But then it ended up on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, a report commissioned by Philip Morris, one of our, you know, world's largest tobacco companies. And what it was they called it the early death benefit. And they argued to, I think at the time, the government of the Czech Republic, that they should oppose increasing tobacco taxes because if they raised tobacco taxes, it would reduce smoking in their country, and it would lead to they're having to pay out more in pensions and so on. It's just exactly the argument that you're making. But here's the thing. From a public health perspective, of course, we don't sort of nickel and dime this. We don't say, well, you know, we're going to take this public health position because it's going to save people money. The point is to save lives and protect our kids against addiction. But I will say that in the new Surgeon General's report, it is noted that, in fact, the cost to the United States in direct medical costs from cigarette smoking and in lost productivity directly due to cigarette smoking are much higher than had been estimated previously. We're talking about in the neighborhood of a total of $300 billion a year. So from that perspective, we will save our society a lot of money by eliminating tobacco-related death and disease. When someone contracts cancer or heart disease from cigarette smoking, they don't tend to just keel over. They tend to end up with very expensive medical care. But that argument, again, has been made, and it's just not the way that we do business here. We're not going to save money by letting, you know, more people die early from this epidemic.
I've got a more personal question for you now, the obvious one. Do you have some kind of personal connection with smoking that has played a role in you having the level of interest in this line of work that you have?
Back when I started in this fight in 1988, so it's been almost exactly 26 years now, I came at it, in fact, not right from the get-go, from a public health perspective, but from a social justice perspective. I became assistant director of a national coalition of health groups like the American Cancer Society and the American Lung Association, combating the tobacco epidemic. But the thing that really bothered me at the time was the fact that this epidemic was caused and it's sustained by a bullying industry. And I don't like bullies, and most of us don't like bullies. I found out quickly that the cigarette companies had for decades been lying to the American people, not to mention the world's population, misleading us, manipulating their products deliberately to addict. And in fact, many of these things now have led in more recent years to this industry having been adjudicated racketeers under the RICO statute by a federal court in Washington. But so it was the social justice side of it that motivated me right from the beginning. But I also quickly came to fully understand the enormity of this epidemic. It's unique. You know, we can talk about other causes of death and behavioral challenges in our society and the world, and they're very significant. Think about HIV, AIDS, and automobile accidents and alcoholism, and there's a whole range, obesity, obviously. But frankly, nothing approaches tobacco. So from the very beginning, that motivated me, and it continues to fire me up every morning.
Let me get to the three questions. First, what's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
Well, this chapter, I guess, is the stay with it and keep fighting chapter, because that really is the theme here. After all of these years, I continue to be reinvigorated in this fight. To me, very little could be more important, and we see the fruits of our labors. I'm joined by a cast of thousands now across this country, and we've got a wonderful international, worldwide network of concerned citizens taking this on, and so I guess that would be my chapter.
Second, what's your worst trait?
Well, it's a typical one, I suppose. I'm impatient, and to carry on this tobacco prevention fight requires a combination of impatience, but also the sort of mental state of an ultramarathoner, and sometimes that's difficult.
And finally, what professional or creative achievement in your life so far has surprised you the most?
Well, I'll go back to early in my career, in fact, and it continues to have an impact now. Early on, I met a whistleblower, a scientist from within the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company, who helped me develop what became a significant media expose that ABC News ran on a then program called Day One. This was in 1994. And the exposure of the industry's manipulation of nicotine to addict millions of people prompted the Food and Drug Administration at that time to attempt to regulate tobacco for the first time. It spawned a series of very prominent congressional hearings focused on industry deceit and other media exposés, and also spawned a series of many years, in fact, of litigation against the industry, some of which I participated in. And so that was, I think, really the moment, because it was a surprise. I knew that that issue of manipulating people and manipulating this drug delivery product was significant. But I, like everyone, I think, was amazed at the waves that it caused.
That was Cliff Douglas. Cliff, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Grant.
For a longer version of the interview you just heard, go to WRVO.org, and please also join me again next week on WRVO Public Media for more conversation in the public interest.